Judge Kessler just called and told me he had a horrible situation at his apartment. His dog apparently went nuts in the apartment and wrecked it. So he can't be here. But I'm very thrilled. The court is very excited about all of these things that we're doing because despite the bad press we get from time to time, our court is very, very into doing whatever we can to continue to improve the criminal justice system. So when the Criminal Justice Integrity Unit has a project, the court totally buys in. They have good suggestions, and I'm glad that they're here today. I'm also happy because, for those of you who don't know, the court oversees an $18 million, hopefully we'll get it back up to where it used to be with this next session, but an $18 million education grant for the education of judges, defense attorneys, and prosecutors in this state. And we also have a small part of that amount that's set aside specifically for innocence training. And I'm happy to say that I have representation today from K-Law, which is an organization out of Plano, the Texas Center for the Judiciary, the Defense Bar, and the Prosecutor. So thank you all for being here. Because what the unit likes to do is we like to look at issues that have come up that may be problem situations for the system. I will talk to the court about it. The unit will talk about it. And what we like to do is bring people in for discussions or education so that not only the unit members who span the entire criminal justice system, but the court and our grantees can be educated on these specific topics and then spread the information to all of the constituents. The grantees have been wonderful about doing that. So, for example, years ago, we had some speakers come in and address us on eyewitness identification. And as you all know, we now have legislation with regard to eyewitness identification. All of the grantees picked up on that and educated. They are now all educating a lot on Brady with regard to the Michael Morton Act, and they will continue to do that. So this is what we do. With regard to the unit, several of our members could not be here today, but I carefully selected and casted by the court members who would not be bomb throwers, because you can't get anything done with bomb throwers, but were really interested in these topics and would actually work. So I'm very pleased to have the group of people that I have. And I have a new member here, Senator Rodriguez from El Paso. And he is, I met him last year when the defense bar had me come to El Paso, or actually we were in Rio Doso, so it's pretty nice, to present. And I met him and he was very interested in what the unit and the court was doing. And so we asked him to join our membership. Senator Uresti is also a new member. He is from San Antonio. He could not be here today. He's in mediation in Houston. Senator Ellis has been a member. I think he was going to send somebody from his office. We do have a representative from Senator Ellis's office. And we are tape recording this. So people that can't come can listen to that and learn what we've done today. But I would be really horrible. I'm horrible at a lot of things, but I'd be really horrible if I didn't introduce my right-hand man who has helped me. This is the file that we have just on this project, and that's my research attorney, Carson Guy. And Carson is incredible. He's rolled into this. He writes articles for the bar. He's incredible, and so he has helped me amass all of this stuff. Now, what we're here today to talk about, court in no way is here to dictate to anyone, okay? We want to share ideas. We have major stakeholders here, and that's very important. We have a representative from DPS. We have general counsel from DPS. We have Mr. Brothers from Inmate Services. We have people representing TDCJ. We have prosecutors. We have defense attorneys. We have people just interested in this topic, and of course we have a representative of the general counsel from the Forensic Science Commission. Okay, we have members of our staff who work on these issues from day to day. So we have this group together because we want to share ideas with regard to notification. And we talk about notification in terms of irregularities, I'm not going to call them mistakes or horror stories or any other horrible term, irregularities within the criminal justice system. An irregularity can be a lab malfeasance. It can be Brady. It can be things that we haven't even thought about yet. And when we talk about notification, I'm going to let you in on a few things that are kind of humorous to me. I have been appointed to the National Commission on Forensic Sciences. I'm happy to represent the state of Texas. There are two of us from Texas on that committee, and the other one being Dr. DeMaio, who is with the Forensic Science Commission, as well as a well-known medical examiner. And there are only 30 people on this commission. Now, when I talk about what we have done in Texas with regard to eyewitness identification and training in general, everyone in the rest of the country hates us. I have been invited to present in many states, a lot of times to Washington, D.C., and when I talk about all the successes we've had, they never invite me back. They are sick of Texas, but too bad. So with this project, I hope once again to make Texas the shining light. And by the way, the legislature loves it. We go in to present, Judge Keller and I have to present the budget, and we go in and present these success stories that we've had. The legislature loves it. They like to be shining stars too. So this is good for everybody. And hopefully we may be able to get some extra funding for certain projects that are important to us in the criminal justice system. I have spoken to several states. I have talked to the feds. I've talked to a lot of people about notification. And just so you know, we have the best buy-in from all the stakeholders beyond anybody, okay? Even the feds. The feds are presently doing a project with regard to microscopic hair analysis, as we are doing in Texas. But for example, when I talked to a representative there, they told me that they were having a real hard time notifying people. Well, obviously you gotta notify people when there's a problem. You gotta notify the affected people. And they're having a problem with that because they told me the FBI told them they can't find people. What? The FBI, you probably wanna talk to some of your other agencies because I'm pretty sure they can find you, okay? But I spoke to the director of DPS, and he assured me that DPS would do whatever they could to help us notify people. I've spoken to people from the prison about helping us because, quite frankly, if we have to notify criminal defendants who are incarcerated, the prison's probably a good place to start. And I've talked to Mr. Brothers with Inmate Services, who's very willing to make sure that we get notice to people. And we've got defense attorneys involved. We have the Innocence Projects involved. So we've got a lot of really good buy-in. What I want to do today is to get information from you. I was gonna steal this from Carson. He had a good analogy a few minutes ago. He said, make sure they understand we don't intend to build the ark today and hope that it's raining when we leave. We hope to get information, input from everybody, and come to some meeting of the mind, so to speak, to have the best notification system that we possibly can. We're not here to dictate to 254 counties how they should do it. We're here to give assistance, guidance, and come up with some best practices with regard to notice and protocols in these areas. So I know a lot of you have some helpful suggestions. We would hope that after this meeting, you continue to send us helpful suggestions so that we can develop some best practices, okay? Now, when I talked to the state of Virginia the other day, their crime commission, they've been working on a notification project since 2007. And they've still got a lot of holes. So I told them, oh my gosh, 7 years, I'm hoping to have this done by the end of the year. No, you can't do it. Well, I don't know if we can do it by the end of the year, but I don't think it's going to take us 7 years. We're a little better than that. When I talked to North Carolina, they're still working on their system. Everybody's working on a system, but we're going to be ahead of the curve. We already have some people that are doing some incredible work. We have Mr. Rhodey, who is the district attorney from Galveston County, okay? And he has provided us, and he has been kind enough to say it, to tell me I can share them. Unfortunately, I don't know how many people would be here. But he's already got sample letters for situations involving some problems within the system. And so he's a good source to give you examples. Mr. Wyckoff from the Harris County Public Defender's Office, who's their chief appellate lawyer, also provided us with some sample letters. So we already have things that have been done and done well. Harris County puts out great letters, notice letters. Roe Wilson is here to represent Harris County. They put out not only lab situation notices, but Brady notices as well, as does Dallas County. So there are a lot of places where people can go to get information. When I started this system, I had to rely on my staff and central staff. We have several members who used to work for inmate services, and I had to go and ask them exactly how it works. How does it work so that people in prison get notice? And so they broke it down, and our head of our RIT section, who's here, Mr. Stoffaker, started to explain it to me. He's using some kind of jargon I can't understand. Don't tell me truck mail and all this stuff I don't understand. Tell me exactly how this occurs, okay? Then I talked to Mr. Brothers and I said, now look, I need your help on this. He said he would do that. But I said, I want to make sure that people affected really, really, really get notice. So I know darn well that there are probably people in prison that throw oatmeal at the guards, or hopefully it's just oatmeal, but they're throwing something at the guards, and I'm wondering, do they really get their mail? Are they really getting their mail? Are they being punished and their mail's being withheld? Because when we have a problem, we want to make sure they get noticed. We can work that out, okay? So, when we look at notification in these areas, and from the information I've gathered from all the millions of people I've talked to, you gotta start with, obviously, identifying what the problem is. Okay, so you identify the problem. If it's a lab problem, a Brady problem, sometimes it's the same thing. You identify the problem, and then you gotta worry about who you're gonna notify. Now, this is what, the common thought is on the categories of people that need to be notified. Unfortunately, I have some disagreement with some of them, but this is the common theme. The first people that have to be notified if there's a problem obviously have to be people on death row. They're in the most precarious situation, so to speak. Death row first. Then people that are incarcerated. Then you've got people that are on probation and parole. Then you've got people that are out of the system. And the feds go so far as to be concerned about deceased people that had been convicted. Okay? I don't know how far everybody here feels we should go. If we should go that far, I don't know whether it's a resource thing, but this is what the feds are doing. The feds are very concerned about really, really old cases, cold cases. So with hair analysis, for example, what they have done in the federal system is they had the Innocence Project, the National Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and members of DOJ or NIJ or one of those J's working on these cases, and they pulled 25,000 hair cases, 25,000, pulled them all. They reviewed them, they whittled it down to 2,500. And what they told me their biggest worry was how to contact people that had cases that were 20, 30 years out. Didn't know how they were going to do that. So I said, well, why can't you, if you can't find them, you can't find their last known address, you can't find their last attorney, FBI won't track them down, all of those things. Have you thought about having an AP piece? Now, you wouldn't want to necessarily name the people. They probably wouldn't like that, especially if they're living in some nicer location and have a new life. But an AP piece where you say there's something wrong with this technician or there's this problem, if you have a case like this, here are some people that you could contact for assistance. If you have an AP piece, trust me, it'll be carried by the internet, and the people will, if they're interested, and they're not taking the attitude of, you know what, I'm done with that, I never want to talk to anybody in the system ever again, then you can contact them. I mean, you can only go so far. You can't beat yourselves up on these cases that are that old when you've got other problems, particularly when people are still being incarcerated. So these are some of the things that we have learned, and we have learned some things from situations that have already occurred. We have learned lessons, for example, with regard to the review that the Forensic Science Commission did with regard to arson cases. And they are presently doing a review of microscopic hair cases. And so, Lynn, I don't know if at this point you would like to say anything to anybody about what you're presently doing, or if you want to say anything about the lessons you learned from your arson review, or to tell them maybe how you're going about looking at these cases so they understand.
Sure, do you want me to?
Sure, you can.
Hi everybody, I'm Lynn Garcia from the Forensic Science Commission. And just to be clear about the arson cases, it's not actually the Forensic Science Commission that has reviewed the arson cases, it's the Office of the State Fire Marshal. But because we're familiar with those cases and have interacted with the fire marshal, I feel like there are a number of things that we can share. Number one is that if you bring stakeholders together who are interested in making sure outcomes are just, you can get a tremendous amount accomplished. And we've definitely learned that working with Judge Hurley as well. Number two is that sometimes you have to correct the path. So if you go a certain distance along, for example, the fire marshal did in the arson review and realized at a certain point that maybe he hadn't done enough to do outreach to a certain community, he self-corrected and then people were able to come together. And I think that review has generally been held up as a model for the nation. The work that we're doing right now is a result of an identification by the Federal Bureau of Investigation that a number of its analysts had overstated the extent to which hair microscopy analysis could be used to link a defendant to a crime. And because the FBI trained most of the state, county, and local examiners who do hair work, the ASCLAD lab, which is the main accreditation body for all of our crime labs here in Texas, advised the laboratories that it would be a good idea for them to take a look at their cases. So our Texas Association of Crime Laboratory Directors got together and wrote a letter of support for an initiative that we're doing to look at some of those cases. And what you find is that the big question becomes, how do you notify defendants? What we're going to be doing in collaboration, we have a review team that's really representative of a number of stakeholders. We're going to be screening out, I'm sure, a lot of cases. But when we get down to the point where defendants actually do need to be notified because there is some irregularity, as Judge Hurley says, in their case, how do you actually contact them? And through, some of you may be familiar with some a drug analyst at the DPS regional lab in Houston that had some issues with some of his analysis. What we learned in working on that case is that different counties, I mean, that case affected over 30 counties in the Houston area all the way down, you know, to Galveston. Depending on the resources that the county has, defendants may be notified or they may not be notified. So our shining examples of model notification are really sitting in the front row here. Jeff Brody from Galveston, we have Bob Wyckoff and his counterpart from the Harris County DA's office. But you can also imagine that a number of the counties I called, there's one DA and maybe he or she has one assistant, maybe. And so it's really hard to try to tell that county, you need to do X, Y, or Z. And I don't, and the way Texas works, that's not going to fly, and for good reason. But what we can do is try to help those counties access the resources they need through TDCAA and other avenues to make sure that they are able to provide good notice, that they have the support and the help they need to do that when necessary. So I won't ramble on and on, but these are just some of the challenges that we've found. It both applies, old cases have their own special peculiar challenges because they're old. But even when you're dealing with cases currently in the system, like the drug cases that I mentioned, we have a new complaint involving firearms analysis that's probably going to trigger some similar issues. So you really have to figure out how to be effective and how to help support folks without saying you must do X, Y, or Z. You know, how to really encourage people to move toward best practices without ramming it down their throats, because that's not going to get us anywhere. That's what we're looking at from
Thanks.
Forensic Science
Commission. Thanks. And what's important, I went to a meeting that the Forensic Science Commission had, and there was a representative from the FBI, and he had some sample letters that they put out. And this is just my personal opinion. I'm not speaking for Lynn or anybody else. But the letters were so long and so involved that I was having trouble understanding what they were talking about. So when you're putting one of these notification letters together, it's not going to do anybody any good if it's way above their head. So you've got to figure who your audience is. And I'm not here to say that people in prison can't read or anything, but if this is science and there's a problem, you know, most of us in this room wouldn't necessarily understand. So it's got to be enough information to give them the idea that something may be amiss. It's got to be enough information to know who they can contact for help, and enough information to give them some idea of what's going on. Okay. Ideally, every time there is a problem, it would be great if someone could personally deliver these notices to people. I don't think that's possible. I don't think Mr. Brothers has a million people working for him. If there's a problem, yeah, they could probably help and make sure that person understands. But we do have people that can help. We've had people step up to the plate. We've had people like Bob Wyckoff and the PD's office. We've had people like the Innocence Project, and Jeff's there somewhere, and Nick from the Innocence Project of Texas. And we have several Innocence Projects in this state that can help with this, okay? And they can offer assistance. And with regard to the notice, none of these people, when they're giving notice to the inmates, for example, go and say, hey, I'm the lawyer that you need, you know, I'm the one that you've got to hire. They just tell them, look, there are resources out there to get you help. I have an issue, and I need Patricia or Sam to answer this question for me, or Gary. I'm married to a criminal defense lawyer. That's my cross to bear, what can I say? But I asked him, and I asked a couple other defense attorneys that I know real well and that do excellent work. I said, I want to know, if there's a problem in the system, would you rather be notified and handle that case yourself, or would you rather have somebody like Jeff handle it? And they all told me the same thing. Well, it depends. And I'm sure it does. It depends on, did you hate your client? Did he hate you? Do you know anything about how to file a writ? That would be a handy thing to know. And, you know, are you going to have to spend a million hours? And there are all kinds of considerations. So for me, it boils down to, okay, my basic concern is whoever handles it, and I think the last known attorney should be advised that something may be amiss in their case, but we really need people that know what they're doing on these cases. So you really got to assess whether the last known attorney knows what they're doing with regard to writs. Yes, Mary Ann?
Okay. Just a couple of points. No disagreement. If a person is still incarcerated, your perhaps first line attorney can be the staff counsel for offenders. That if they got a letter from the FBI, they might at least be able to interpret it for them. But there's something else that has been percolating in my brain, and you know how dangerous that can be.
That is.
Yes. And I kind of mentioned it to Blackburn. This forensic issue, I don't think, is going to go away.
Yeah.
Okay. We now have a public defender's office on Capitol Ritz. Okay. I think I would be going back to the legislature and say we need a public defender on forensic writs and let them become your experts, and they have the investigators and they have some scientific support, you know, of experts, et cetera. And they just get paid for by the state of Texas, and they can take cases from the Innocence Projects at the law schools if they want to refer them. I don't have all the details tossing around in my head, but you get the drift of what I just think you're going to need a permanent group.
I agree with you, and what other states have done, and it's not worked out too well. Other states have called upon their state bar for pro bono services. Well, pro bono, I mean, if they don't know how to do this work, then, you know, saying, oh, I did 100 million hours of pro bono, aren't I wonderful, so I could be a super lawyer in Texas Monthly or whatever, isn't going to help the situation, okay? So you're right. We do need people that know what they're doing.
And Judge, I think it would always be a mistake to count on the last lawyer that represented the defendant to do something, because most people, when they represent a defendant, they're done with them. And there's a lot, unfortunately, there's a lot of defense lawyers, if you notified them and you expected them to do something, the whole system would fall apart. It has to be something like Mary.
But do you agree that they should be notified?
They should be notified, but that's more of a courtesy than anything else.
So they go, oh, darn. I'll use darn.
Right.
Maybe I screwed up.
Well, most of them are not going to do anything to deal
with it. Okay. Now, I also have a concern, and I'd like some input on that. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Brooks.
Yes, I agree with the last comment. I think that most lawyers, you talk about cases that are probably going to be several years old, maybe 10, 15 years old. And a lot of the trial attorneys may not even have the file anymore. So contacting them as a courtesy is probably all you're going to get. To get them involved in the case is probably not likely to happen. Notification is the first step, and nothing's going to happen without notification. So I think my colleagues who work in your office understand snail mail or truck mail, but there's also the possibility of doing regular mail and certified mail if you know the location of the inmate. Regular mail does go to prison units. They don't just rely on truck mail. So I think that just, that's...
Perhaps you could define truck mail.
Well, truck mail is simply the prison system using its internal system to put mail on vehicles that they deliver mail to different units. And not all units have truck mail, but a lot of units have truck mail. And that is not a reliable way to send notice to an offender.
And I don't think the truck mail goes to the state jail units. When I was at the state council,
right. It doesn't go to state jails, and there are a lot of units that don't have truck mail. So you have to rely on regular mail or certified mail, and that's the best way to get noticed to someone.
Now, a semi-humorous aside on the concept of certified mail, with regard to people that are out of the system, was that the state of Virginia, a lady was pretty funny, she said, they decided we were gonna send all these people from last known addresses, whether it was from the lawyers, from the trial judges, from the district clerk, whoever, and they sent out a ton of certified mail. It was a complete disaster. They wasted a bunch of money. So then they sent out a second wave. And the second wave had little forms inside that said, are you so-and-so who was convicted of aggravated sexual assault. You know, yes, let me write in and tell you about how that went. So they spent a ton of money. So she said, don't do that. Learn from our mistakes. So I just thought I'd throw that into the mix. Bro.
One thing that we did in Harris County before we got a public defender's office
is that we would ask the presiding judge to appoint one attorney to handle the cases. And in fact, before Bob Wyckoff was with the public defender's office, he did that on a project that we had where we had to do notification. And it gives consistency in the way the cases are handled, and if you get somebody who knows how to handle it, and it works much better, I think.
Great.
Yeah, when you were saying notifications like an AP and things like that, the ECHO, they have a prison newspaper that all the inmates read assiduously. And if there is an issue, say, regarding bad DNA tests in certain counties, whatever, that could be something that could be put in the ECHO. Oh, by the way, if you've gotten a conviction between this year and that year, there may be a problem with it. That would reach the people who are currently incarcerated.
Okay.
The danger of that, though, is my understanding is that you have a case where you've already identified a problem with a particular case. So we're not talking about notice in a paper where you're going to end up getting a flood of letters, because, you know, as the Shawshank Redemption, there's only one person in there. Everyone else is innocent. So you don't want to. You can put a notice, general notice,
yes.
But that's not going to satisfy the type of notice I think you're talking about.
Yeah, and I was just saying that would be something you could do in addition.
Yeah.
Just sort of put people on there.
Okay. Pat, do you want to talk about how
we do it?
How you do it? Pat's from DPS, so.
Well, if we have an irregularity in one of our labs, as soon as we recognize that, we have a written process. We call it a quality action plan. Basically, it's we failed, our quality process failed. But as soon as we realize that, we have a formal process we go through. And part of that is, as Judge said, you got to realize you got a problem and figure out what your problem is. We do a root cause analysis to see not only what went wrong, but why did it go wrong? How do we prevent this in the future? So we go through that process. If it's an analyst that basically fouled up an analysis, which the first thing we do is we take them off casework, get them whatever retraining they need, and then we competency test them before we turn them back on to examine the evidence. So that's in-house what we do. If we find out that we've issued a lab report that's incorrect, we go back and retest that evidence, and we send out a corrected report, and that goes to the law enforcement agency. So that's our process. If it's depending, I guess, on the severity of the thing, then like the situation we had in Houston, we then notified all of the prosecuting attorneys. Part of the QAP or quality action plan is to not only look at the one case that we've identified, but probably all of the other cases that analyst has worked in the last, say, 6 months or so, to see if there's additional problems, similar problems that analyst had. So we don't look at just the one case that we initially find. We go back and look at their recent history and farther back if we see that there's a reoccurring problem with this one analyst. And then also, if we have to get evidence back from law enforcement, typically after we analyze evidence, we return it to law enforcement agencies. So as we contact those agencies that are affected, for instance, our Houston analyst, he had examined about 5,000 cases over 6 years. So we notified every agency for which he had analyzed evidence. And we identified the actual cases that he had identified. if those agencies wanted us to retest that evidence, they resubmitted it, we retested it. So depending upon the irregularity, we do a little or a lot, but we do enough to ascertain how big of an issue was this and over what period of time.
Did you get any response from law enforcement agencies that you're not submitting notification to the ultimate source? You're submitting it now to your client, who's a law enforcement agency.
Right.
Did any law enforcement agencies actually send you the stuff back and say, retest it?
Oh, yes. We retested about 500 cases.
That seems like a real recipe for a dead end street. There's not any follow up on it. It'd just be almost good faith to have the law enforcement agencies. And what do you do when the counties that you're talking about, where you've got one prosecutor and a secretary, and the law enforcement agency may not be much bigger? Or
add a really important point that DPS also notifies the Forensic Science Commission and their national accrediting body, which is ASCOD Lab. So a lot of the reason why we are here where we are is because DPS did notify us right away. And then we said, how are we going to tackle this notification issue? And that's when we started working with Judge Hervey to figure that out, bringing all the stakeholders together. And that's where we identified this issue of, you know, major urban areas with lots of resources, notification went out, boom. Just model. But when you get down to the smaller counties, what we need to be able to do is give those folks the it's not that the prosecutors don't want to do it. They may not be aware or understand the full scope of the scientific issue and how it actually impacts the folks that are in their jurisdiction. So there are a couple of suggestions that we had. One is that DPS be available to give a presentation to talk to folks about, in layman's terms, about what it really means when the analyst does whatever it is that he or she did, and what the potential implications are for those other 4,944 cases. And then sort of what we're here to do, I think, in part, is to really try to tackle that issue, which is DPS, when it has, or any forensic laboratory, they identify a critical issue. Usually it's going to rise to the level of, say, negligence or misconduct. They notify what is referred to as their client, right? Law enforcement, sometimes the DAs. What happens after that? So that's what we're trying. I mean, Judge Hervey has just, it's incredible to me. Every single issue we identified as a gap, because we had a stakeholder roundtable and issued a white paper on this, she's gone to the right person to really try to nail down how do we fill the gaps. So, you know, having DPS able and willing to say, we will send a letter to the last known address that we have for that person's license or state ID, I mean, that's huge. That's huge to be able to do that. And other things that we've talked about too.
Well, and we will have a further white paper with the Forensic Science Commission. But before we move too far from the problem that was in the Houston area, I'm going to ask Carson to give you a little summary of the court's opinion in Cody, because there have been some things put out about the case that perhaps been misunderstood or maybe might be slightly incorrect or, you know, something of that nature. And so the court would like you to understand what we really held in Cody. So, Carson?
Thank you, Judge. I'll be very brief. Thank you for listening. Basically, what I wanted to say was that under the prior case that governed from this court, Ex parte Hobbs, I believe what the court essentially decided was is that the evidence that was in the custody of the laboratory technician in this case was compromised because it was so unreliable because of the malfeasance that had been discovered. Unfortunately, there was not as much analysis perhaps as we would have liked, especially in light of the fact that future problems have developed in other states and here. And so the court readdressed the issue in Ex parte Cody, which was handed down on January 15th of this year. And then Cody, I think it was really just trying to clarify Hobbs largely to explain that it's a due process issue, that when false evidence is used to convict the criminal defendant, that can be the equivalent of false evidence. And if an applicant or a habeas applicant can prove or show a pattern of misconduct on the part of the laboratory technician, then this court will assume that that evidence was false, although it may not have actually been proven in fact to be false. There are some factors, obviously you can look up the case. Some of them include that the technicians committed multiple instances of intentional misconduct in another case or cases. Obviously that the technician worked on the applicant's case and that the misconduct was the type of misconduct that would have affected the evidence in the applicant's case. And that happened roughly within the same time period. I think that was one important factor because a lot of laboratory technicians do great work. They've worked at these labs for sometimes decades, and problems can be isolated to a single instance, a single few instances, and they can span years, but I have yet personally to see a misconduct case where the laboratory technician was engaging misconduct the entire time they were employed. So I think that's important, but going back briefly, that as I said, if an applicant, when they file a writ, can establish those elements, the court will assume that that evidence is false, that the results of the testing are false, and that potentially that the custody of the evidence is also false. However, one change that was made from Hobbs was that there will no longer be a presumption either of a materiality determination. Under Hobbs, falsity was assumed and materiality was assumed, therefore there was a due process violation. Under Cody, I believe that the burden has been shifted slightly so that the applicant has to at least establish that the laboratory technician in question has, like as I said, engaged in a pattern of misconduct, but also that the false evidence that was produced by the technician, which could be lab results, and the custody of the evidence itself, which could be drugs or any other type of item they might have at the lab, is not reliable. And I think that goes to the basic premise that people should not be sent to prison based on unreliable evidence. And then finally, as I said, at this point also, the applicant needs to show that the false, these quotation marks, because we might be assuming that it's false, although hasn't been proven false, that it was material to their conviction. Because in some cases, as cases came up to the court, it was discovered that there's other evidence in other cases where that might show an applicant's guilt, where say, a police officer did a presumptive drug test that was positive or something of that nature that happened before the laboratory technician in question actually took custody of the materials. So Cody did represent a shift and hopefully was also, I think, meant to help clarify the due process analysis as well as to provide a roadmap. Unfortunately, for potential situations like this that could arise in the future. I think to pretend that situations like this will never arise again when the members of the criminal justice system in Texas are human is to ignore the truth. And so hopefully that can represent a roadmap, while not setting the bar so high that people that have no scientific knowledge themselves, defendants, can never get relief. So I think it was important to try to split it up a little bit and to give everybody a fair shot there. So.
Thank you. And while it talks about materiality, one thing that's really important that everybody in the system understands, and I've seen this with other states, I've seen this with the feds, a lot of people in the system want to make the materiality determination along the way on these issues. Hate to tell you all this, but the materiality determination in situations like this belongs to the Court of Criminal Appeals. So people get that wrong all the time. And, you know, we're going to review these cases and we're going to decide which ones are material. No, that's That determination belongs up here. That's an appellate decision by this court for the state of Texas. So a lot of people don't get that, but, you know, that's how it is, okay? So Rob, tell us about the good work TDCAA does to help this process along.
You talk about on notification?
Yes.
Obviously, when we get word that there's a problem, our job is to communicate that out to all of the elected prosecutors. For instance, in the Houston situation, we were able to contact all the prosecutors that were on that list and had those cases and made some recommendations as to how they should handle that, what they should start doing with that. So we're just kind of a point person for communicating with all the elected prosecutors in the state. I think we'll continue to do that when these things arise. We'll continue to get that information out and recommend what their next step should be.
Okay. Jack, do you have an opinion about how soon in the process the prosecutor should be notified of an irregularity?
Well, I would say as soon as possible, so that, especially in counties that are smaller, we can start doing whatever we need to do to try and get resources in place. With the most recent incident in Houston, we modeled our response on the way Harris County had already handled responses like this, with similar situations in terms of drafting the letter, notifying the court, and especially asking the judges to appoint defense lawyers like Bob, who knew habeas, who knew what to do in that situation so that you weren't having to reinvent the wheel. But that all takes time to get in place. We also brought in a former prosecutor on a contract basis to manage the project. She had knowledge of the habeas process. And so we had a little money in our budget to do that. So as soon as there's indication that there's going to be a problem that's going to affect that prosecutor's county, I speak for myself because we can't speak for one another, but I would assume we would want to know as soon as possible so we can start taking action to have a consistent and fair response.
Okay. Tricia, do you have something that you would like to share with us from the perspective of the defense bar?
I think all I can really share with you now, having just been in my new job at TCLA for a couple of months, I can't really speak on behalf of TCLA, but I can say, as being a member of several different criminal defense bar associations, I have seen a lot of good communication. When one lawyer finds out there's a problem, lawyers tend to want to get the information out to other lawyers, and I think that's a good thing. To add to that, I kind of want to circle back to what we talked about earlier in terms of when you're talking about notification, should you go as far back as the original defense lawyer? And I agree with what everybody said. I certainly don't think anybody ought to be thinking that that person is going to do the work on it. I do think it's a courtesy, but on top of the courtesy, I think it's very important to put in that notification that that lawyer ought to be asked to keep his file if he still has it. And I know some of these cases may be real old and it may be kind of a moot point, but I've had plenty of occasions where writ lawyers have contacted me, and fortunately, I've kept my files for 20 years. But it's helpful, and Bill Allison knows too, you know, talking about the Morton case, you know, everybody wanted to see what was in his trial file. He didn't have every single page of it, but he had a big portion of it, and so I think it's important to, as soon as we're sending that notice, try to do something to see if there could be preservation if the file still exists.
Okay. And is this communication between the federal attorneys on a federal basis as well as state, or how is...
I can't really speak about federal. All I'm talking about right now is from the perspective of a defense lawyer with various different county associations. And I know TCLA is pretty good about communicating with each other. I just can't say systematically in the past how to make handle notification issues.
Judge, can I follow up on what Tricia said? And what Gary said originally is this. You set up notifications to criminal defense lawyers. It could be a 20-year-old case. They don't have their file. They take a look at the letter. They send it to the shredder. That's the end of it. There's a real simple thing that can be added to that letter that doesn't cost anything and would probably increase by a few percentage points effectiveness. And that is just in the letter, not only say don't destroy the file, but say
if you know who's the successor, who's the appellate lawyer, who's the lawyer handling it, get in touch with them for us. Doesn't cost anything, you know, maybe a sentence long. Some lawyers are going to actually pay some attention to that, might actually do something, and it's for free. And I'm not sure that you can't do the same sort of thing, a notification at the level of a prisoner, an inmate, if you know who your lawyer is, if you have any resources, family member, something, get this to them. But, I mean, a prisoner's in the worst position of all to help themselves. They don't, can't do anything. But they might even get the mail out to somebody, include that in it, say, help me. So.
Jeff.
Well, you know, it seems to me the only reason we're really here, the only reason we have a problem is because we don't have a public defender system. If we were in a state that had one of those, it wouldn't be any issue like this because somebody's there to take care of it. Now, here's the problem that we do have. And out of the Innocence Project in Texas, we engineered the arson review. We've been doing the heroin fiber review. And ultimately, the problem in these cases is going to come down to what we're all kind of talking around. Who do you notify, because who's going to defend these people? I want to harken back to what Mary Ann said earlier. We're in the beginning of an explosion, a really good explosion in forensic science, and we're going to see a lot of changes happen and a lot of needs to review old cases. What we don't have is a specialized bar that can do that. But what we do have is a very specialized problem that can be solved, I think, fairly easily, and I want, again, get back to what she said, because Mary Ann and I have talked about it and I've given it a lot of thought. I think this is an example of where a specialized public defender system, like we've done in capital cases, for example, could have huge benefits and would also take care of the notification problem. Because no matter what we do, Harris County's done great, great work with this. That's why we call that the Wyckoff letter now. The Heron Fire didn't be so long, they got a Wyckoff letter.
Of course, they're only half of the good work, the other half is the DA's office.
That's right, and Jack has done great stuff, and we're all doing the Heron Fiber stuff together. But Harris County is an anomaly in this state. It's one out of 254 counties. There's a PD, they can do this. Most other counties, you can't do anything of the sort. And we're fooling ourselves if we think, oh, well, criminal defense lawyers will all get along with each other and they'll notify. No, they're not. Most of these people were probably paid $300 or $400 to do the whole case 10 years ago. That's not going to happen. You cannot count on them. We need somebody else that can do this kind of work. So the issue is, who do you notify and how do we do it? Anyway, I'm not trying to get us off track, but I mean, it just seems to me that that's a really critical component when we talk about these, especially these forensic disasters, irregularities, whatever we want to call them. We need to have somebody responsible that knows how to handle them. Really, the fact that these innocence projects are doing it is kind of wrong because that's not really our job description. We shouldn't be doing this. We're only doing it because there's nobody else to do it instead. So, thank you.
Sid, how do you envision the trial court's involvement in this process?
Well, I'm assuming that at some point after the notification occurs, the writs will be sent back to us for termination preliminarily and then show up to you. So we will be involved. You know, Bexar County does not have a public defender system, but I can tell you getting people to represent these kind of folks in this situation on these kind of specialized writs, even by court appointment, is going to be difficult to find the caliber of person to do that. So I'm all for a specialized statewide public defender's office that would have people that have the knowledge and the ability to do it. Save a lot of time and effort for everybody.
What do you think about training the judges so that they know how to handle these cases?
I don't have a problem with that, but in order to have the judges rule correctly, you've got to have the evidence before them and the lawyers presenting it correctly. And the record has to be properly preserved. So I think it just seems a lot of these counties are not going to have the resources or the people there to do it. The judges in some of these smaller counties might have a general jurisdiction bar where they do mostly civil divorces. They're not going to have the expertise to deal with these. So training for the judges, I think, you know, we have plenty of mandates, so it sounds like another mandate coming down the pipe. But it's really who develops the record. And I think that's where we need this statewide office that perhaps could take the brunt of it for everybody, including the smaller county.
We try real hard to stay away from mandates because...
That's the legislative mandate, not y'all.
I know. But we try to steer them away from mandates too because...
Could you issue one with every opinion?
Or call polite suggestions. Polite suggestions, especially if they're signed off by all nine of us. But I appreciate everybody's remarks. I do want to tell you, we're going to take a break in a minute, but I do want to tell you about some other things the unit and the court have done and are doing, continue to do. And that's, we're going to continue to work with stakeholders with regard to Brady issues, okay? The grantees are doing a great job training on this issue. However, there probably needs to be some discussions because there are some concerns about fallout from the Michael Morton Act. So the parties will get together and they'll talk about those things, and I'm sure they will address the legislature with regard to their concerns about the Michael Morton Act. What I want to tell you, though, is that we will continue to work with police officers on training, as the DAs also train. The court did work with the State Bar. We did put a Brady video together, an hour-long presentation. They got Keep Close credit for it. We sent it to every police agency in the state. We didn't get any feedback. Nothing. You heard nothing. Usually the court gets, you know, some response to whatever we do. We heard absolutely nothing. We paid for it all. They all got it. And hopefully they're using it. But we have talked to the people at TCOS, and they would like the unit to look at their components with regard to, they don't put together the training, they just approve it, the content, okay, for TCOS credit. They wanted us to look at the content of their components for Brady, and they also wanted us to look at their components for report. So we will attempt to do that. We're also, Lynn, finally getting to the point where we're ready to roll on our Brady presentation for lab people. I was on a conference call with some federal people yesterday, and it shocked me that a judge actually stated that in the state of California, their interpretation of Brady is that the entire burden is on the prosecutor. So anybody within the system that, you know, screws up or makes a mistake, it's entirely the responsibility of the DA. And I said, really? Because I don't think I read Brady that way. I think it's the prosecution team, and there are going to be a lot of instances where the prosecutor is going to be left holding the bag for some problem that happened in a lab or with the police department. So our concept is that everybody should know something about Brady. Well, this guy disagreed with me. And then a scientist actually said, no, she's right. And where I'm from, we give them some basic information about Brady. However, I think we could step that up. I think maybe we need to encourage more people to have some serious Brady training. And so we are working on that. So that's some of the stuff we're doing. I want as much input from all of you on this situation as possible. We're going to take a 10-minute break right now, and then we'll continue the discussion. Thank you. You are our legislative representative.
Yes.
So is there anything you would like to ask us or add to this or tell us or laugh at us about? Or?
Judge, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to serve on this committee. I find the discussion very... very stimulating, to say the least. I think it's touching on some issues that are very, quite important. That's an understatement. And I jotted with a big asterisk the reference to the ask of the legislature to potentially fund a specialized public defender forensic expert, so to deal with the forensic issues. And I think that part of the discussion was interesting to me because I agree that that might be the best way to go here, in getting a specialized unit to handle these kinds of matters. I find interesting the discussion about the timing of the notice, whether or not, you know, local law enforcement. I was talking to Pat afterwards, but we got on a break about what about those law enforcement that don't request a retesting? What happens there? So I'm quite interested in all of these areas, and serving on the Senate Criminal Justice Committee, I'm assuming we're going to continue doing some work on these issues. But particularly, I would just simply say, whatever I can do to help in the legislative front in making the pitch for additional resources overall, or specifically on this specialized public defender unit, I would be very happy to lend support.
Thank you very much. Now, are there any other people in the audience that have something they would like to contribute, ask, criticize, anything you'd like to add? Cheryl.
What kind of numbers are we talking about in notification? Is it a big range, little range?
It's going to depend on the issue. Hair isn't probably as big as fingerprints.
Overall, do you have any handle on how many are going to be popping up? We just don't know.
We have no idea. We have no idea. I mean, the feds with the hair pulled 25,000 cases. They whittled it down to 2,500. I don't know what the county is presently statewide on cases that they're looking at with hair, but.
We approached that a little differently than the federal government. We're using a sub-sampling project to look at hair, since we're doing it voluntarily. So right now we're looking at about 600 cases. I would imagine once the review is done and we've done some screening out of those numbers, it's not going to be a whole heck of a lot. It'll be maybe a couple hundred in the end. However, in the drug cases, because those are high volume forensic disciplines, you have much, much higher numbers. So in a very short 6-year period, you could have an examiner work 5,000-6,000 cases. So it really is going to depend. You know, I'm talking about forensic cases only because that's the area that I come from, but there may be other criminal justice issues. Certainly the drug cases will be high volumes. The violent crimes, where we look at certain issues, will probably be lower numbers.
And remember, we're basically here talking about forensics. We have other issues within the system, like Brady, for example. So we've got offices sending pre-trial Brady notices. You know, Brady continues, as we all know. So Brady is another irregularity that can occur, and God only knows what we have there.
The other thing is that for people who are not incarcerated and are actually reporting to their parole or probation officers, but the ones that were discharged or absconded, and you need cooperation on this one, but it seems to me that particularly if they have left the state of Texas and you can't track them down for driver's licenses or something else, that the SSA, the Social Security Administration, could be, say, well, here's a name and a birth date. You know, can you give me information? They can say, we have 12 people by this name, birth date, you know, whatever. I don't know if they could do that or not. And if they've had service in the military, the VA might also know where they are, particularly out of state people. So that would be.
Of course, it's tying into the feds, and I don't know what they'll be willing to do.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also, you know, maybe the VA's.
I mean, if the FBI is saying they can't locate people, I don't know what the other agencies will tell us.
There are other state people who say they can't find other things.
Lynn?
And I would just add, from the perspective of the reviews that I've been involved with, there has to be an end point somewhere. You know, we're really trying to do the best we can, and we need to do a better job than we have been able to do so far. But at some point, we have to understand that as a community, we've agreed upon a protocol that we feel gives a really good shot of providing actual notice, that we follow all those steps, that we're consistent. But then after that, if we can't get somebody, they've moved out of state, they really don't want to be found, then at some point we have to make peace with that.
Absolutely. Anyone else? Lisa, you've done a whole bunch of work. Do you want to say something about all the work you've done at our request?
Well, most of my focus was on the Brady issue.
Okay.
As opposed to the notification issue. So I didn't know if you wanted to do some sort of intro into that or...
As I just said, this is not just about forensics. We have to be concerned about Brady. So why don't you just say a few things about what you've been looking into and how much you found?
I've been trying to notify some, or call or email some DA's offices throughout the state to determine how they are dealing with Brady notification issues. Primarily, if you've got a police officer who's been arrested or who's had some sustained disciplinary actions, and how they are notifying the DAs in the office or the defense attorneys or the clients. And most of the larger ones have some sort of list they keep. They might call it the Brady list, or I think Tarrant County calls it the pink sheet. But they will, when they are aware of any issues with a police officer, they'll make this list, and it's available to all the prosecutors, either through email or whatnot, and it is occasionally updated anytime there's some new development. And then every time there's an update, the email list goes back out and highlights what the new issue is. And the prosecutors are expected to keep up with that. And even some counties have a do not sponsor list when they have officers that have serious problems, credibility issues, and they will not sponsor those officers. So if the case comes up for trial and that officer is the arresting officer, they're going to dismiss the case. Part of the problem, though, is them finding out, the DA's office is finding out about these issues. So I think it's important for law enforcement to notify the DA's offices. And I think most law enforcement agencies don't necessarily have any kind of protocol for doing that.
What sources would the DA's office consider? Would they consider as valid a call from a defense lawyer?
That's, in fact, most of the time, most of the time they find out from the defense attorney. There is one, El Paso County told me that their largest law enforcement agency has some person that's assigned to disseminate this information to the DA's offices. So I think if more law enforcement agencies would do something like that. And I think, I can't remember, they didn't say what the jurisdiction was or what his title was, but he's actually an attorney and he's in charge of disseminating Brady information to the DA's office.
Perhaps timing.
Who's that?
We have, we do have a Brady list, just as you described, in El Paso, and 90% of my business is with the El Paso Police Department. It's the El Paso Police Department is the agency that we do that with. And so they send us notification when there's misconduct that they believe reaches the level that should be on the Brady list, and then we review it to determine whether or not it is. And it's exactly as you described. We put it, we notify the lawyers through the mail, we keep the list current. It is possible an officer could be removed. That seldom ever happens. And the list just, it makes it, you know, we are aware of it, and the prosecutors in my office are aware of it, and that's how it's a kind of a living, breathing thing, the Brady list.
Well, Karen from your office was very forthcoming and sent me a very detailed email outlining how your office addresses it.
Karen, the first assistant.
Right.
Bob?
Judge, I just want to let you know that as kind of an association, we're addressing this through training. This is really kind of a new issue, and how offices are handling this is still kind of emerging. There are a number of policies that we've obtained from around the state or around the country. Like Ventura County has a pretty detailed policy about how they handle what they consider to be Brady information for police officers and not, whether it rises to the level of actual impeachment evidence. There's a lot of layers to that. There's actually been litigation in Orange County because they had such a list, and the police officers union sued over the dissemination of that list. Because officers wanted the ability to get their name off of it and wanted the ability to litigate their way out of that list. So there's a lot of issues surrounding this. We're still kind of working on how that's going to go, but I can tell you that most prosecutors understand that it's an issue, and we're going to have to deal with it. Whether it comes from information from the defense attorney, I would think, yeah. Actually, I have a brand new district attorney who knows it because when she was the defense attorney, she's the one who got the information, and now she's the DA, and she's had to call the officer and say, sorry, we aren't going to be using you anymore around here. So it comes in a lot of different ways.
And just, there's been some conversation, just so you know, with law enforcement with regard to their notes, field notes. And some jurisdictions are actually considering the possibility of scanning field notes and attaching them to their offense reports. And so they're doing it more, you know, more closely to the actual offense report, and then, of course, the DA will have it. Some of the officers are afraid that, you know, they're going to be giving up work product. They're going to have to trust the district attorney to protect their work product. But at the same time, they are considering scanning so that maybe the notes and the reports match. That would be good. But anyway, there are some police agencies that are considering that. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Anybody else have anything they would like to offer or share or ask? Mark.
Bureaucratically, I was thinking you might could start off with the expert concept placed with the regional presiding judges. You already have that in place. You've got 9 regions. You could have a pod of however many people they need that each of these regional presiding judges could notify. And you wouldn't have to build a bureaucracy that way, just my view.
That's good consideration. Any and all questions, suggestions, criticisms? Oh, we don't want so many of those. Anything like that. Just so you know what our website is, sometimes it works. Sometimes it works well. It's www.cca.courts.tx.us. And there is a link on there to the unit. Okay, so if you have anything you would like to offer or suggest to us, we'd appreciate it. I want you to know how important this meeting was to me today, because today is my 22nd wedding anniversary, and I'm sure my husband thinks I should be home slaving over a hot stove for this, but I chose to be here instead. But I do appreciate everyone's attendance, and we hope to, we will continue to work on this project. We will work on other projects. We will be ahead of the rest of the country. They can hate us, I don't care. And the feds can hate us, I don't care. But I think we're all doing good work, and the mission of the court is not only to hand down the helpful suggestions every week, but also to see that we continue to make improvements whenever possible to the criminal justice system, because that's what it's all about. So thank you very much. On behalf of the court, thank you.